On the Empire podcast this week, our guest is something of a gimme as Carey Mulligan drops by to talk far from a madding crowd. Gimme, Mulligan, golf joke. So, yeah. Anyway, we also have the usual movie news and nonsense on the movie podcast that's definitely above par. Okay, strictly speaking, above par is a bad thing. Under par is where you want to be. But under par sounds like below par, which is also a bad thing. It's all
what you need right
confusing.
Now, Chris, is an eagle to carry you away.
A giant eagle to carry me away. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Golf Podcast. This week, my two colleagues of such lethal cunning are our art house guru, a man whose favourite golf movie is the underrated Will Smith movie, La Légende des Bagafants. Is this true? Phil Desemlian.
No.
No.
I'm glad to see you are currently wearing a Werner Herzog t-shirt.
I am wearing a Werner Herzog t-shirt.
You bought in the Werner Herzog club shop alongside his range of sportswear. An SUV vehicle.
How good would a Werner Herzog range of sportswear be? It would be very good.
It would, Chris. It would be.
Oh, wait, Phil. Come on, don't get any impressions
that
yet.
That wasn't Werner Herzog. Oh, okay.
Was it? Was
no, just, I don't know. That was just a generic kind of.
You golden larynx sex god, you. All right. Okay, let's leave that for later on. Oh, and leave that bit as well. Phil, you're spoiling all the questions. Stop spoiling all the questions. And let me introduce the other colleague of Lethal Cunning, who is, of course, our geek queen, a lady who agrees with Mark Twain that a round of golf is a good walk spoiled.
Yes.
So what would you call running a marathon, Helen O'Hara, which you did at the weekend, you ruddy maniac?
Yeah, all in all, I might have been better with the golf. Because it's a really long way. I don't know if anyone realizes this, but 26.2 miles, it's really far.
Yeah. I think Mark Twain would have described it as a good distance car journey spoiled.
Yeah, I think, and he would have been right, if I'm honest. No, it was great. The London Marathon, heartily recommend it. The atmosphere is incredible. I would say, though, I didn't learn something movie relevant during this run, and that is that Warner Brothers may have a little bit of work to do ahead of the Wonder Woman standalone movie. Because as you know, I was dressed as Wonder Woman.
Yes.
And a lot of people shouted at me, go Superwoman.
Well, okay.
So there's a little bit of name recognition that isn't there yet.
Did you stop and correct them?
I was very tempted, especially in the latter stages of the race where I would have stopped for anything. But no, I took it in the spirit in which it was intended and waved my thanks and ran on.
See, Superwoman's not even a thing.
I know.
So
but they don't.
Double education required.
Did you see
yes,
any James
it would have taken a really long time if I'd stopped, you know.
Did you see any James Bonds?
I did run past a man wearing a suit at one point, but I'm not actually sure if he was Bond.
Any Peter Lorries?
A Big Ben. Is that any good? No.
A Big Ben.
I saw a Flash who was, God bless him, even slower than me. So that answers the question of who's faster, Wonder Woman or Flash.
No one's ever asked that question. I think the answer is fairly obvious.
I ran with a Superman for a while. We tried to find the Batman, but we couldn't.
Right. Okay.
I saw quite a lot of Spider-Mans, but very few other Marvel figures.
Yes.
And I ran past a guy dressed as Jesus who was wearing only a loincloth and carrying an actual cross and had taken the whole, you know, self-harm thing a bit too literally because he was literally bleeding down his back. It was quite painful looking just to watch.
What?
I can't imagine what state he was in by the end of the course. There was also a dinosaur going for a world record, like a really convincing lifelike dinosaur.
Everybody run the dinosaur.
Well, it did make people run because it kind of looked like a mini T-Rex. Sort of a little bit bigger than in Jurassic Park 2, The Lost World. Mm-hmm. A little bit bigger than that, but not much.
What?
It was really realistic. I'm not kidding. I overtook it at the 1 kilometre mark, though, so I think it must have taken quite a long time to
finish
the race.
That was a mistake, Helen, because as we all know, the T-Rex's vision is based on movement. So by running past it, you actually probably became its next target.
Yes, I did, but luckily it was really slow, so that was okay.
Must run faster.
Must.
Is a Wookiee a bear?
So I'm going to ask, I don't know whether you're willing to share or not, but what time did you do?
I did a fine by my standards, but slow by a fit person's standards, 5:21.
5:21?
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
It's good for my standards. That's all I'm saying. So
right.
I make no claims. I know that a cool person should be run by the 4-hour mark or under. But,
yeah.
You know, marathon number one, maybe it'll get faster.
So is there going to be a marathon number two?
We'll see.
So what you're saying is we should all sign up for next year's London Marathon and do a pod as we're running around.
That would be amazing. Because quite frankly, you should be running at a pace for marathons that you're able to speak at. So it would be good to make sure we're on the right pace if we can pod as we
go. Imagine that? On the Empire podcast this week, shooting pains, left arm, is that good? I don't know.
And there goes the starting gun.
We haven't even started yet, Chris. Get up off the ground. Oh, he's dead. He's dead. And it means we'll never be able to get the questions. No, you guys would carry on, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You would carry on.
I'm not sure.
We'd leave you for dead. Just carry on.
I thought you meant...
Oh, sorry.
Meant in tribute to you.
Yeah, sure.
So anyway. Here are some questions people have been sending in. This is from at Jesus Almighty. And this, I just chose this one at random, guys. Nothing to do with me. After Chris's amazing dinosaur impression.
Oh, God.
In a recent Empire podcast, I have to ask, what other weird slash awesome ones can you all do? Now, I'm not doing any impressions at this point. Okay.
Oh dear.
Because I was thinking about this on the way over to the pod booth.
Okay.
I've worked with you for too bloody long now, Helen, and I have never heard you in all the years we've known each other do an impression.
Is that because, do you think, I'm not very good at doing impressions?
Or maybe you're hiding your light under a bushel.
When have I ever hidden my light under a bushel? I genuinely I don't do them. No, not really. I've done like lines from Arnie, but it's more an impression of your impression than an impression of
my impression of Arnie is an impression of someone else's impression.
Well,
of Arnie,
so it's a beautiful line of things.
Okay.
All right.
Let's do it now. So, I really want to hear you do an impression of someone.
It's sort of get to the chopper. Come on, do it. Kill me. Kill me now. That's all I got.
That's the best Dudley Moore I've ever heard.
Thank you.
It's so good.
Yeah, I leave the impressions to you guys. You have enough going on there.
All right.
Can you do an impression of Chris doing an impression of Peter Lorre?
No, but I can.
Have a go. Just say Helen.
No.
Just say Helen.
No, don't stop it. It's bad
if
enough
Phil
he does it.
Peter Lorre, does it weird you out?
That wasn't as bad as yours, but it's still bad. And I'm going to have to take off my headphones in a minute if you insist on doing it.
I'm not going to do it. My brother's very, very good at impressions. He's got a good ear for them. At least, I think he is. I'm not entirely sure who he's doing often, but I enjoy them.
I really wish Nick were here for this bit because Nick has an incredible ear. As you're absolutely right. He nails the impression. If the impression is Paul Giamatti, because that's who everyone he does ends up sounding like.
Paul Giamatti.
Richard Nixon, Paul Giamatti. Morgan Freeman, Paul Giamatti.
Melissa McCarthy.
Paul Giamatti, Nick Cage. It's all very weird, but he's got an incredible ear. It's just not attached to his head.
It does. Well, like one of those mutant lab mouses stuck to his back.
It's like a Bluetooth ear. It's meters away from the rest of his face.
I was weaned on his Christopher Walken impression.
Oh.
Yeah, which also sounds a bit like Paul Giamatti.
It's an odd thing to be weaned on. Most people go for food, but I mean.
I know. I was malnourished, I'll be honest. But I've already did his chicken.
What do you do, Phil?
Oh, chicken. I'll take it. I do Nick's Christopher Walken. I don't do any. I'm terrible at impressions, as anyone that's heard me try one on this podcast will testify.
I've got a feeling.
Michael Caine, I've tried and failed with. Everyone does a Michael Caine.
Everyone. Okay, Helen, we're going to do your Michael Caine.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Phil, hit me with your Michael Caine.
My other problem is like I always misquote the films as well. So it's a double whammy, a bad impression. All right,
just
she was only 27 years old. He didn't say this, but
all right.
Wait, there's a bit in The Eagle Has Landed where he goes all Cockney.
Okay,
and he says something like, "You remind me of something I picked up on the sole of my shoe on a hot day, very unpleasant on a hot day." And I don't even know, that's not any of the words from the line. But it's a good bit at the beginning of the movie. There's all, obviously, the classic Zulu ones.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Zulus.
Great.
Over amazing.
There. Wow. There's Zulus coming over here.
Wow. Yeah.
No, as I say, I'm not good at impressions at all.
I think I've chosen the wrong week to ask this question. Sorry, Jesus Almighty. Helen, all right, okay, what? Before we move on, your Mark Twain impression. Your Michael Caine impression.
I genuinely, that involves an accent as well, which I definitely can't do.
Oh, come now.
Come on, have a go. Come now, O'Hara.
I can't do it. Michael Caine. No, I can't do it. Caine. I can't even, Caine? What's?
Michael bloody Caine.
Michael bloody Caine. No, I can't do it.
Right.
Michael Caine. The secret is to do that. Just do the impression of Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon.
That's what you do. That's all you do. And then you go down, lower. Master Bruce. Like Rob Brydon does it. That's all you do. You just impersonate other people's impressions of famous people. That's all you do.
Helen and I can both do a good Buster Keaton in the General, can't we?
Go on, do it right now. That's fucking amazing. That was spot on. Destructive, but really, really good. We don't have a pod booth anymore, but that was really, really good. Apologies for the swears. I will do one quick thing.
Okay.
One quick thing. This is Sean Connery, okay?
Okay.
Accessing the internet via dial-up. Okay?
Okay.
I'll say it again. Sean Connery accessing the internet via dial-up. Splendid. Okay.
Was the best you have ever done. Like, ever. That is genuinely the funniest thing I've ever heard from you.
That's very good.
Next week, Sean Connery riding a lawnmower.
Have you been working on that since your Y2K project? It's technologically about 10 years out of date, but I liked it.
I'm going to the fringe with that one. All right, let's move on. Next question is from @TokeMyers, who says, in Avengers Age of Ultron, no character has a standout theme tune. That's not true. That's not true. Iron Man's theme is prevalent, as is Thor's theme, which I don't know what it is, but I was told by the composer that Thor's theme is studded all the way through the movie. I don't know what Thor's theme sound like.
Well, I guess at least his music gets a look in. Oh, snap. Boom.
What's the best character theme in any film? Says Toke Myers.
Mm. So is it cheating to say the likes of Superman, Indiana Jones, Bond?
No.
Then I would like to answer.
Okay. Helen, in the voice of Michael Caine, answer.
Oh, no.
No, don't.
Yeah.
Superman, Indiana Jones, and Bond. But Indiana Jones probably edges it because he actually has two themes. So they couldn't decide on one, so they kind of went with both. So, Indy.
Mm. Okay.
Okay. That's pretty good.
Phil. I know you've made lots of notes in this one, and Phil has an audio presentation to make.
Oh, I do. Yeah,
he does.
Yeah, you stood on the high ground with those ones. They're classics. But what about the Imperial March?
Well, I wasn't sure if that was like a specific character because you hear it with Vader.
Yeah.
But you know, they call it the Imperial March, not the Vader March. So
this is deep and semantic now, isn't it?
I think Luke has a theme.
Yes.
Leia has a theme. I like those.
Yes.
Yoda has a cracker theme. Yeah, the Imperial March is Darth Vader's theme.
I think it's
a belter.
Yeah, okay. It is a belter.
All right, then.
I think we'll count it.
Yeah,
why
fair
not?
Enough.
The motif, if you want to get all highfalutin, kind of emerged in as a way of instantly recognising the character and the mood.
Uh-huh.
So it was an important part of the character building.
It's a Wagnerian concept, I think you'll find.
Oh, my Lord. So. This has... got a little late night Radio 3 all of a sudden.
Googled that on suds.com.
Hence Ennio Morricone's themes in all the spaghetti westerns, but especially once upon a time in the West.
Harmonica.
Oh, I love Cheyenne. I love the Jason Robards theme.
Yeah,
it's so perfect for that character. And if you think about taking the theme away from the character, it strips him of quite a lot of his kind of, you know, it brings a little bit of like comic clownishness to it, which I think it needs because he's actually quite a serious journey in that film.
Mm.
But mine is Jerry Goldsmith's Patton theme.
Okay, go for it.
Which I love. The only issue is that it sounds almost identical to the music from Police Academy. So I want you to tell me which one is which. This is piece one.
Hang on, so that's Patton.
That's part one.
That's Patton.
No. Yeah.
Is that Patton?
Hold on. No, hold on.
Sounded like Police Academy.
Get another go.
Okay. That's Patton.
First one was Police Academy.
Very good.
Yeah.
Very good. You're correct. But they are remarkably similar. And Axel F. by Harold Faltermeyer.
Of course, absolutely.
Speaking of great character themes, from Police Academy, the horrendous running gag where the two cops keep going to the gay bar, the Blue Oyster. And every time they go in, the music's like... That's always stuck in my head. Who doesn't love... I mean, yes, Superman gets his own theme. Planet of Krypton's got a great theme in Superman the movie. Mm-hmm. But I love the theme that accompanies Ned Beatty's Otis in Superman. Which, ooh. It goes a little something like this.
Yes. Chris actually brought in a trumpet just to play that. He learned to play the trumpet just to give you that.
Carl and Ellie's theme in Up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although it's actually, I mean, it's called Married Life, so I don't know that we can really call it their specific character theme.
I'm going to anyway.
Okay, fine.
It's kind of tricky because, you know, a lot of the big major themes are kind of the film themes. It's like, is the Halloween theme Michael Myers' theme? Mm. Or is it the sort of more somber? And
Harry Potter's theme is actually Hedwig's theme. The one we think, do-do-do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah.
That's called Hedwig's theme.
Yeah.
It seems odd that the owl gets the best music, but there you go.
Mm. Oh, and always on a horror movie trip here, but Jason Voorhees does have a cracking theme. That sort of, it's very, very moody. Cha-cha-cha.
Well, if we're talking about horror movie characters, then, you know, Bruce in Jaws.
It's Bruce!
Bruce is here!
There's no business like shark business.
Right, okay, now we've mangled that question beyond all recognition. Once again, do write in if you think we've missed out any of the great character themes. I thought those answers were very good, so if you do, you know, write in, then you're just a nitpicking Nelly. But please do write in
Chris,
to us.
What? No! They work. Write in, you can improve everything.
Improve us. Please improve us. We're on Twitter as @EmperorMagazine. Use the hashtag EmperorPodcast. You can email us podcast@EmperorOnline.com and you can Facebook us as well. We are Empire Magazine on the Facebooks. Quick reminder early in the pod, in case people don't stick around for the end, that our Daredevil Spoiler Special podcast is out now featuring Charlie Cox. It's very good. And our Avengers Age of Ultron Spoiler Special featuring Joss Whedon and Paul Bettany will be up on Monday, May 4th, Bank Holiday weekend over here in the UK. It may be up earlier. We may put it up Friday, Saturday, maybe. So keep them peeled on that one. And when you're listening to the Age of Ultron podcast, listen for something a little extra at the end with Helen and myself, because we came back into the pod booth after the main recording session to record some new thoughts in the movie after I saw it for the time and Helen saw it for the... time, we had some extra thoughts. So think of that as our very own post-credit sting, if you will, on that movie.
Your tuberculosis looked at?
It's really bad. It's really bad, guys. We're going to segue smoothly into movie news now. A couple of people have demanded that we react to the Star Wars The Force Awakens second teaser and the Batman vs. Superman trailer that we completely forgot to mention on last week's show because they came out so early in the news cycle that we forgot about them, and last week had lots of news. But shall we very briefly cover that off? Let's start with Star Wars reactions.
Loved that.
Hooray.
Brilliant. Batman versus Superman, colon, Dawn of Justice.
I mean, it was certainly dark and gloomy and raining.
So you couldn't see anything.
I hope the weather will improve for them.
No wonder Batman's miserable all the time.
That's it. You know, why does it always rain on him? That's what I want to know.
Because my parents died when I was 17.
Topical.
Big fan of Travis.
But, I mean, I'm hoping for the best with that film. There have been lots of stories recently that, you know, DC is still not quite sure what it's doing with its shared universe, and lots of stories about different scripts running around for Wonder Woman and for Aquaman, and nobody quite knowing what exactly they're going to do with those films, with those characters. But presumably somebody's going to take the reins and take over. Presumably Zack Snyder is going to have a say in some of this, and certainly is going to set the stage for all of it in Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. So I'm just kind of hoping for the best. But the teaser didn't 100% blow me away, I think it's fair to say, but I'm still just hoping that it will do so in future. I did like the idea that they're kind of tying it into sort of real world paranoia politics and all of these kind of talking heads on the TV discussing what Superman means for the real world, which I think is quite clever, because I think the idea that everybody would very calmly accept him, which is essentially what we used to see in the Christopher Reeves movies,
yeah,
not actually that realistic. It would cause a bit of a crisis of faith and...
geopolitical crisis.
Like, indeed.
Who does he belong to? Who does he fight for?
Well, that's, I think, what Watchmen did quite well.
Yeah.
You know, Dr. Manhattan is the ultimate nuclear deterrent, and he lives in the US, so what does that mean for the balance of power? So I thought that angle was very interesting. So hopefully that they can make something really clever out of this.
Just play devil's advocate.
Sure.
Don't you want your Superman to be bright and breezy and...
Yeah, but that doesn't mean...
Maybelline.
In the same way that I think the reason that Captain America the Winter Soldier works so well is because you've got a really good man in a really difficult situation, you could theoretically do that with Superman.
Okay.
You could have Superman himself, if he was clear on what he does, which I don't think he was in Man of Steel, but if he is clear on who he is, what he wants, and what his aims are, then you can put him into any situation and that will be compelling, even if the situation is very difficult.
I think the reason Captain America Winter Soldier worked so well is because the writers realised what they wanted to do with it very early. They had this idea of doing a 70s conspiracy thriller, and they fitted everything into that really nicely.
Yeah.
There doesn't seem to be any clear notion with this yet, but that's still to, to emerge. So
I
there's
agree.
Still time.
Yeah.
There's still, I haven't finished
there is still
it yet.
Time. I mean, when we talked to the people behind Man of Steel last time, it's clear that they had actually put a lot of thought into the kind of the themes and the stuff that they were talking about. We did those spoiler specials.
Yep.
If you guys haven't listened to them, I genuinely recommend them, and even if you didn't love the film, because, you know, they had put a lot of stuff thought into these themes and a lot of consideration into that, and hopefully this time they have put the same amount of thought in, but it'll come over even better.
That's the hope. I mean,
the
feeling has always been from the moment Batman v Superman: Dawn of Justice was announced that it was a film that was kind of scrambling from the off. They were very much in the back foot. There's a feeling, it may, however true it may be, that Batman was a very late addition to that film, and there, it was a Man of Steel sequel, and then it became, oh, hang on, we can put everyone else in here, and then we'll start our universe, and we'll get off with a big start with the two heavy hitters, and
yeah.
And they kind of, there's a feeling that that's the way they're going with the rest of the universe. There's no singular vision. This is all based off a Hollywood Reporter. There's a Hollywood Reporter article which quotes a lot of inside sources, basically saying that there's the methodology is to get a lot of screenwriters competing, which screenwriters don't like. They don't like that idea. They don't like that approach. But yeah, hey ho, we'll see what happens. Suicide Squad is shaping up to be tremendous, I think. So that's good news. Did we discuss the Joker? It happened after we went live last week. So that's discuss. Jared Leto's Joker, which David Ayer, the director of Suicide Squad, tweeted a picture last week of Jared Leto with, if you haven't seen this, I don't know where you've been, but tattoos all over his body, his naked torso. So he has, like, he's an incredibly literal Joker. He has ha 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 written all over his body, and he has, you know, mom and love and hat. And I think, and he has, and this is the one that's attracted most criticism. I liked the look. I thought it was interesting. You have to do something new and different that we haven't necessarily seen before with this Joker. You can't just rehash Nicholson or Ledger. But he has damaged written on the middle of his forehead, which means that this is not a Joker who like subtext very much. I suspect the backlash to the damage thing in particular has been so over the top that I imagine they probably won't go with that in the finished film. But we'll see.
There's been a little bit of a move away from that picture since it came out, hasn't there? There's been a sort of, oh, that's not necessarily the finished look. And some of the onset photos don't appear to show him looking quite the same as that as that image. So it's an interesting move, if that is indeed not his look, but it certainly has become extremely memeable, I think it's fair to say.
It did pretty much stop Twitter on Saturday morning, didn't it? It was like, wow, every single person's tweets had a picture of the Joker in it. It was like watching, I don't know, it was like the world's scariest playing cards kind of and scrolling. But is there not a sense that he will be progressing to that look during the movie? That it'll be a little bit like Daredevil in the sense that
I think he's fully formed by the time we...
Is that right?
We could see Harley Quinn. We could see Harley Quinn whimsically tattooing him with ha ha ha.
Mm.
I could imagine her doing that.
Did you tweet something about who would be brave enough to spend hours inking the Joker in a professional...
Yeah. It wasn't me, but yeah, it's a valid question.
Yeah. So yeah, maybe we'll see that.
Maybe they were all done by himself in a mirror.
Yeah.
In two mirrors to avoid mirror writing.
So Mr. Joker, just to get this absolutely straight, how do you spell ha 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 ha? Just to be clear? Okay. It's 10 ha's. Brilliant, I got it. and damaged, which I keep reading as Damaged. I don't know why, but it just, and the people are slagging off the font as well, which is something I love. The Joker would never go for a cursive.
It's not Damages, is it? It's not like, do you want The Good Wife or Damages?
I've been watching both. The Good Wife, actually. I'd go for that.
Good Wife.
Yeah.
What do you think otherwise? He hasn't got the face makeup, but presumably that will happen at some point. Because the idea apparently is that he's fully formed, he's in Arkham Asylum.
Sure.
At the beginning of the film, so Batman's already caught him and stuck him away.
I think it looks interesting. I think Leto's a good shout for that role. He does look completely different to the ones we've had before. He does look like the Joker. Like, you look at that picture, and even with all the crazy tattoos and the grill and everything, you kind of say, oh, that looks like the Joker in a weird way. In that there have been many different iterations of him in the comics, and somehow certain things ring true, and that did look like him to me.
He looks like a man who's been forced to listen to 30 Seconds of Mars on a loop for 24 hours. That would make anyone write Damaged in the middle of their head, I think, to be honest. Great stuff.
Fingers crossed.
Great stuff. Let's move on from comic book movie news to comic book movie news. Kingsman has hit $400 million worldwide, and now Fox have officially announced that they will be developing a sequel. Interesting. Fun. See where it could go.
Interesting. Matthew Vaughan's obviously been semi-linked with the Flash Gordon film, so question is whether he'll do a Kick-Ass 2 on this one and just step away from the directing gig or come back for another go. But he did seem to, when he was on the Spoiler Podcast, seem to be very enamoured with the idea of doing another one himself.
Yeah, my feeling is this is more of his baby than Kick-Ass was.
Yes, absolutely.
And this is, they're developing it. I don't think he's in a position to go and shoot it now. So... He might do something first, whether it's Flash Gordon or not, I don't know.
How long, realistically, would they want to wait to make another one of these?
I say the window's 3 years in these things, isn't it? Really? Anything outside that, you have to kind of remind people of the concept. 3 years, 3 to 4 years, maybe.
Mm.
But we'll see. But also, there's lots of questions about who might come back and in which form and what the story could be. I mean, Fawn has talked about he wants to include American Kingsman, which is an interesting idea. He wants big names to play the American Kingsman.
Who's the American Colin Firth?
Well, and
Stanley Tucci?
He said Clooney and people like that. But whether or not that would work out, I don't
Ambitious.
Know. Yeah. But you never know.
The point was that they were sort of quintessentially English.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But they are meant to be in the comics. They're an international group, aren't they? The Kingsmen. Aren't they? Am I misremembering that?
I don't know. I can't remember. I can't remember. But certainly, yeah, it seems like a very British organisation, so I don't know how Americans would fit into that. But Mark Strong's Merlin would be undergoing a makeover and a almost complete personality change, which could be fun. Camping it up, that's all I'm going to say. So that could be quite fun. All right, so let's move on. This is the interesting news. This is kind of confirmation this week that the much ballyhooed 21 Jump Street meets Men in Black combination movie at Sony, which is really, really desperate for a big franchise that it can spin off into a universe with Ghostbusters and Spider-Man and now this, might actually be happening. And there might also be a female spin-off-centric 21 Jump Street sequel a la Paul Feig's female Ghostbusters.
Yeah. Mm. The Men in Black Jump Street franchise idea is such a bananas concept that...
It's clean and rad and powerful, according to Jonah Hill's email.
Well, to be honest, it's such a bananas concept that if it was anybody but Phil Lord and Chris Miller, I think I'd be screaming and running. And because it is them, I'm like, yeah, all right, let's see where this is going. That's from somebody who watched Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs again at the weekend, because, hey, why not? The female-focused 21 Jump Street, I mean, I'm never going to, you know... I'm never going to reject female-focused films because there aren't enough. 13% of Hollywood leads are women, etc. But do we need to choose a side with every film? Can we not just have, like, instead of having boys' schools and girls' schools, can we not go co-ed here?
It does, it whiffs a little bit of, yeah, well, there's that. I mean, are we talking about a film in which Emma Stone and Rebel Wilson team up and get instructed by a shouty Queen Latifah to go to high school? I mean, is it retread?
I don't know.
It wasn't an original idea in the first place, obviously. So it does get a bit daft. I think you're right. Sony are very desperate at the moment to get something up and running. And they've got Tom Rothman, who's fresh behind his desk at the top of the organisation. So there's lots of things being kicked around. And I presume he wants to make his mark early on with some big decisions. I don't know why this would be one of them, but who knows? There's a lot left to be said. It's written by the screenwriters of Broad City, which I haven't seen, but I understand is really, really highly rated and well thought of. It's a kind of girls like New York.
Mm-hmm. I've seen some clips online and they were funny.
I haven't seen it, but yes, so they're obviously well thought of. Don't know. It seems weird. It really seems weird, especially as the other franchise is still going and, you know, and the whole joke was that it was a bit meta in the first place. How much more meta can it get?
Yeah, but it's not like this, you know, the world of 21 and 22 Jump Street are so sacred that we can't accept something that
yes, they bloody Shmitenchenko
might get recruited by the MIB. I can kind of see it working. That's the weird thing.
The MIB stuff I'm totally on board with because it's so completely mental. But
what would they call it?
21 Men in Black?
Men in Jump Black. Street the Men in Black Jump Street crossover I get. Yeah. I just don't know about the sort of, you know, this one.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
It's a bit interesting, yeah.
It's a bit interesting. Just about a bit interesting. Also interesting this week in sequel news, a lot of sequel news, as you might expect. Micah Monroe, formerly of this pod booth, has joined a cast of Independence Day 2 as President Whitmore's daughter. And this has caused a slight kerfuffle in the States, this one. Because Mae Whitman of Arrested Development fame and Scott Pilgrim vs. the World originated the role to indelible effect in Independence Day. And some people are going, well, hang on, why was Mae Whitman recast in a role that, frankly, I can't even remember existing in the first place?
So she was adorable.
She was the dork.
Yes.
A dorks.
Dorkable.
She, who could forget?
I did.
Who did she play?
I didn't realize it was her, though.
She played the daughter.
Yeah. She played the daughter.
Yeah.
Is Boomer coming back?
The dog.
The golden.
It's probably. 20 years,
it's
Phil.
It's been 20 years.
I don't know how to break it to you, but no.
CG, the magic of CG, I don't know. Well, I understand why there's been a bit of a fraud. Anna Kendrick weighed in on Twitter quite fiercely about this one. Mm-hmm. The suggestion being that Mae Whitman isn't enough of a leading lady type and that they needed more of a to play this role. But she's just come off the back of her success, hasn't she? The Duff was very successful.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It seems a lot of anger about something. I'm not really sure why they've done it. No one's really... Roland Emmerich hasn't come out and explained the decision, so it might be worth just hanging in there until he does a bit of press and he says, we've done it because... Also, we've had Micah Monroe in this very pod booth recently, and she's very talented. We didn't discover that on the podcast, but obviously in her films, and I think she's going to be a big star. So... I don't know. She's good too.
She is great. But my point is, if it's a role that you can't even identify with an actor and it's a role you don't even remember being in the film, then I'm not necessarily going to get up in arms about it being recast. It's not like they've recast Jeff Goldblum's role, which is identified with him.
I think the point is that there's a sense people feel like she's been cut because she's not enough. She's not beautiful enough to be the leading
blonde.
I don't know. Yeah there's an aesthetic dimension to it.
But who knows? But for me, it's about, are you irrevocably linked with a role? And I don't see it with this one. I didn't even remember the character in the first place.
I remember the character. I didn't realize it was her. But you know, there is something to be said for.
Yeah.
If somebody did play the role and is still an actor, kind of, why would you not? And maybe there are reasons. Maybe she's committed to something that we don't know about yet, which means she can't do it. But Micah Monroe, we like her, so...
Yeah, hey, okay.
Let's hope for the best.
Starts shooting soon in New Mexico, Independence Day 2. This is obviously a sad note on which to end the news section, but the great cinematographer, Andrew Lesney, the guy who shot a lot of Peter Jackson's movies, including both Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit trilogies, and whose last film was The Water Diviner, died this week of a heart attack at the age of 59.
Yeah, very, very sad news indeed, because frankly, these days, that's very young, and his career was still going from sort of strength to strength. So it's really upsetting news, and it was very, very sudden. You know, it wasn't like it was following a long illness or anything like that, so I think it's come as a bit of a shock to film fans everywhere, but he had done some absolutely beautiful work. If you think about Babe for a moment, even apart from his much better known work on Lord of the Rings, that is an utterly gorgeous film. And it has that sort of that fairy tale kind of golden glow across the whole thing that just makes it kind of magical looking. And that's even, you know, aside from his actual stories about magic. He did things like I Am Legend as well. He did The Last Airbender. He did Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Gorgeous, gorgeous work. Tributes flooded in from, I think, everyone who knew him and worked with him. And yeah, it's a very sad day.
And he was very, very good at combining landscapes with visual effects.
Yeah.
And, you know, getting the lighting
just right.
for that. And I think obviously these days that's more and more important skill for a cinematographer to have, so I think he'll be much missed in the filmmaking community by people like Peter Jackson and the other collaborators.
Yeah, it's been a lot of really heartfelt tributes to him on Twitter this week. Russell Crowe and Elijah Wood and Ian McKellen and Peter Jackson took to Facebook to say essentially they considered each other to be brothers. And yeah, it's a really, really sad loss. The Water Diviner and The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, were his last two films. The Water Diviner, as we discussed in this podcast a couple of weeks ago, is a beautifully shot film, reminiscent of great cinematography of David Lean movies. So it's a fitting tribute in a way to Andrew Lesney, who died aged 59. Something else to discuss on the podcast this week on a slightly more upbeat note is the new issue of Empire. We have one here in the pod booth. It is Glorge, which is a combination of glorious and gorgeous, and it's a word that I'm standing by. It's fantastic. On the cover is a world exclusive, Jurassic World exclusive, if you will.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Oh, yeah. I don't just throw this shit together, Helen.
Well, you do.
I did. Yeah, that was complete blundered into that one. This is on the cover. How would you describe this? It's a weird cover. It has the that's not the right word, is it?
It's a weird cover.
It's a weird cover. Buy it now, folks.
It's a slashed cover.
It's a slashed cover. Yeah, there are four claw marks in the cover. You pull back the cover to reveal another cover, and there we see the Indominus Rex, the bad guy of Jurassic World, revealed in all its glory for the first time properly. It's been seen in the trailers, bits and pieces, but this is it on the cover.
Each copy has been individually hand claw slashed by the office.
The office raptor
we brought back from the South.
People are going wild at four claw marks because the Indominus Rex is a genetically engineered dinosaur and has four claws.
Well, although I'm looking at the claws here in the picture, just inside the cover, so you've got three claws pointing one way and a sort of an opposable claw, pointing the other way, which doesn't actually fit these claw marks on the cover.
It's technically correct, Helen. I think you'll find.
Okay.
I think if an Indominus Rex were to come in here right now, and slash us, there would be four marks down the center of our chest.
I'd be counting how many claw marks you had carved into your chest. That's all.
Yeah, I think you'll find. Look, there's only three.
What else is in the magazine, you guys?
Well, I'm not finished talking about the cover, Phil.
No, it's good.
It's
a hell of a cover.
It was worked on. We worked diligently with Colin Trevor, the director of Jurassic World, to get this image just right, so it's fantastic. And what else is in it? I can't even remember what else is in it. There's more world exclusives.
More amazing stuff. There is Tomorrowland is in it.
Yep. I wrote that, so apologies in advance.
There's an Anna Kendrick profile. I wrote that, so apologies. Yeah. There's the women of Mad Max Fury Road. So that's
neither of us wrote that.
Fierce
so.
Lineup. Yeah, we don't need to apologize for that one. Whoever wrote it can apologize.
Fierce. I haven't heard. Oh my God, that's a Tyra Banks word if ever there was one.
They are literally fierce, in the proper sense, not just the Tyra Banks sense, but also that sense.
Yes. What else do we have?
We have the report from the Empire Awards, the Jameson Empire Awards in March.
Jameson.
Whichever. We have 40 things you never knew about Jaws. Now there is a challenge for you. Did you know any of these
things?
The shark
was called Bruce.
What?
It was not a real shark.
No.
There's no business.
Robert Shaw,
like shark business.
Didn't die during the making of the film. I thought they'd bit them in two. Apparently not.
Oh.
Yeah.
Gosh.
The shark did his own music.
And also a piece on the Magnificent Ambersons.
Yes.
Orson Welles' great missing film.
Absolutely.
And the people who are trying to find it.
We also have world exclusives from Bryan Singer and Simon Kinberg, who gave us some lovely X-Men Apocalypse concept art. That movie started shooting this week, as did Captain America Civil War, in fact. And we also have so that's some great stuff, some really fascinating insights into that movie. We also have Chris McQuarrie talking us through Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation. The pint of milk this month is Maisie Williams. Thank you very much for The Falling, which is out in cinemas right now. And we have set visits from the likes of Magic Mike XXL. We also have set visits from the likes of Trainwreck, Magic Mike XXL, and the first look at Daniel Radcliffe and James McAvoy. Technically the second one, because we did the first look back in issue 300 in Victor Frankenstein, as Victor Frankenstein and Igor, in fact. Plus, loads of movie news and reviews and other features and great writing and pictures, and sometimes the words in the pictures actually match and it's all good. And we recommend very, very strongly that you buy it, because I like to be able to eat, and please help me. £3.99 in all good and evil news agents.
Is it true that if you open the back cover, you get hit in the face by a stegosaurus tail?
It's not true, Phil.
I was misinformed. misinformed.
But people should probably buy it and try it to find out.
But there is a crossword.
There is a crossword. And Mark Strong is this month's movie mastermind. And he scores... I'm not going to say. But also the Jurassic World feature itself is fantastic. Nick was on set of the movie in New Orleans and spoke to Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard and Colin Trevorrow and B.D. Wong, who's returning as Dr. Henry Wu in this one. He spoke to loads of people. Spoke to Frank Marshall. He was on set with a Velociraptor. He was in the movie. Nick's in the movie. We think he might be in the movie. He plays someone called Edmund. So you can read about Nick's adventures as an extra in Jurassic World, along with stuff about the film itself. And it's really, really, really quite good indeed. Who are Jessica Chastain, Superman, Liam Neeson? It's all there. What an issue! What an issue! Right, sold, done. Have I flogged it enough?
Yes, let's move on.
All right, let's move on. Time now for this week's guest, a lady who in an incredibly short space of time has become one of our greatest actresses and, dare I say it, an icon? Dare I say it?
No.
I dare not say it. Okay, she's Carey Mulligan, who shot to fame with an education and has only enhanced her reputation over the last few years as, say, the new Julie Christie, with cracking and tastefully chosen turns in the likes of Never Let Me Go, The Great Gatsby, and now this week's Far From the Madding Crowd, in which she follows in Christie's footsteps by playing Bathsheba. Bathsheba?
Bathsheba.
Bathsheba in the Thomas Vinterberg, Thomas Hardy adaptation, which is a whole lot of Thomases. We sent Phil along to speak to her recently. Enjoy.
Carey Mulligan, welcome to the Empire Podcast.
Thanks.
I appreciate you taking time to chat to us about Far From the Madding Crowd.
Yeah.
My first question to you is, how do I get the word madding into conversation?
Madding.
Yeah, how would I want to use that word? I just don't know how to. Any suggestions?
Such a good point. You know, the Americans have been calling it Far From the Maddening Crowd.
The Maddening Crowd.
Yeah.
Well, after the director, John Madden.
Yeah, exactly. After John Madden himself. Madding. Madding. Yeah, that's a challenge, isn't it?
Any form of kind of assembly of people.
Yeah.
A little disorganized or a little kind of rambunctious.
Come on, we're late to go to the Madding.
A madding.
There's a madding happening.
A madding we shall go.
There's a madding happening at the town hall.
Yes.
No, it doesn't work, does it?
I don't use the word town hall that often in conversation.
Yes. I don't know what town hall I'm even thinking of.
Well, I think you've put me on the right track. I'm going to try it later today. You play, now, pronunciation, I knew the character, obviously. I didn't know how to pronounce it until the film.
Well, you can take your pick, I think, because I think the Julie Christie version say Bathsheba, and we say Bathsheba. Just to be contrary.
I think I prefer your version.
Thanks.
It's kind of, it's sort of antique in a way, but yeah. It's a very modern character.
Bathsheba. Bathsheba, yeah.
Are people coming up and saying, is this anything to do with Katniss Everdeen? Or assuming you're some sort of spin-off of the Hunger
Games? Yeah, which
Games?
One came first? I'm sure we will get a bit of that. Yeah, Bathsheba, we had to be very clear every day to remind people to call her, because lots of characters in the film use her name. And so we had to keep on reminding people not to say Bathsheba, so we didn't have a lot of...
Oh, yeah. It'd be annoying to have to do ADR and get people just to pronounce one word.
You know, when you do a film with sheep, there's a lot of ADR anyway.
I was going to ask you about that, because I think when I heard that Thomas Vinterberg, the man who was obviously the first person to make a Dogma film and establish the rules of chastity with Lars von Trier in Denmark, made Festen, which is one of the best films ever made almost.
Yeah.
And I was interested in, well, first of all, you know... Can't believe the sheep had to do ADR. You know, obviously he's not. This isn't a Dogma film in any way, and he's moved on a lot since then. But is there any kind of semblance of that? And how would it manifest for you?
It's one of the most sort of relaxed sets I've been on, in that you don't feel, you know, and particularly for a costume drama, you're kind of just, you know, Charlotta was the DP. She shot The Hunt as well, which is a brilliant film, and it's handheld, and you know, you rehearse a scene and then you pretty much do what you want. You know, they liked whatever set you're in so that you can move anywhere. And we were outside, you know, we were outside for 70% of the film. So there was a real freedom to it. And I guess, you know, it's funny when you watch the film, it's so beautiful. You don't really think, you think, gosh, there must have been an awful lot that went into that. And there was, but when you're on set, you just felt like they just were thinking about you and what you were doing as actors. So I think there was definitely a kind of freedom and a something kind of, you know, the way that Thomas works, very kind of relaxed.
It is a beautiful looking film. I mean, we're looking at the big version of the poster, which is one of the images of the year so far of you.
It's weird. It looked like that in real life.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
So we walked down this sort of...
We're just to put it into context for listeners, because this isn't very audio friendly. We're in a wood.
We're looking at this thing. We're not going to describe it.
No, you were in a misty wood and you're in an embrace, a romantic embrace with Tom Sturridge. And
in Scarlet.
In Scarlet, and it's very striking. The colours are very striking.
Yeah, it was an amazing setting, and we walked down into it, and it was sort of down quite a steep hill, and it looked as extraordinary as it does on the poster. Now it was really amazing.
Any squirrel problems?
No squirrel issues down there. Bathroom issues though. Bathroom is very far away.
How far was the bathroom?
Too far.
Okay.
Yeah. Especially in a corset.
For people that don't know the book or the John Schlesinger film or haven't seen this film yet, Bathsheba, she's a very modern woman, isn't she, in many ways? Because she comes into some money and some property, and she's sort of expected to marry the first person.
Yeah.
And there's three men in her life.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, I mean, you know, you wrote to Alastair Julian Fellowes, didn't you, when you were coming up? And he suggested that you marry a lawyer.
Yeah.
I just wondered if you've sent him a copy of the book and said, no, look.
Yeah, look, there's so many options.
Don't try acting. Try settling down and marrying a man.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. She gets an offer of marriage before she even has anything as well. But I loved that, you know, because I think I'd been nervous of costume dramas. I've been kind of staying away from them. I mean, this kind of British, you know, Victorian literature kind of thing. I did it a lot when I was starting out, and I was aware that at a certain point you become a British actress who just is in British films, wears corsets, and I thought that would limit me in terms of getting to do other stuff, particularly getting to play Americans. And so I kind of stayed away from it for a while, and then this came along, and Thomas Vinterberg directing it was sort of, you know, it was too good to be true. But yeah, I think it does feel, you know, it does feel sort of different in that respect. It doesn't feel like a sort of traditional costume drama.
No, it doesn't. I mean, you've made sort of subtle changes to the character a little bit from the book. She's a little softer, I think, more empathetic in some ways.
I think so. I think that's also in the edit, though, as well. Like, I think that's also in the way that Thomas is...
Or is there a scene where you're just slaughtering
There are so
sheep?
Many scenes where I'm being a total bitch. No, it she is, I guess, in a way. I mean, I loved her, so I suppose it wasn't me trying to sort of make her softer. It was just that I had a real empathy for her, and I enjoyed her so much. I enjoyed her flaws and her contradictions, and I loved playing those things. But I guess she's not as, I don't know, I haven't seen any other versions. It was genuinely the only version I had in my head of who she was.
So the deleted scenes are going to be full of just bitch outs.
Total nightmare, throwing shit.
Psycho episodes. Yeah. Is it true that you saw The Hunt, and half an hour later, you went to meet Thomas to talk about this? Because I saw The Hunt, and half an hour later, I was in a dark room just reminiscing on my life.
I did. I went to see it with a friend. I came out, and we both sort of stood in the street staring and not talking.
It's
and
a
then
brilliant
I was
film,
like, oh,
but...
shit, I've got to get in a car. And then I went and met him. And then the first words I spoke were to him. And then, you know, I think I'd sort of, in my head, I'd agreed to the whole thing by the end of the meeting.
That was at the Savoy.
It was at the
Savoy, right?
Yeah.
So you've got to have a stiff
and
drink.
I also like, because, you know, he directed Feston, so I was like, and I didn't Google him. I didn't know what he looked like. And I, you know, so I didn't know that he was this sort of young, you know, gorgeous Danish man. I thought he was sort of probably sort of wrinkly and old. And, you know, so I was sort of walking in expecting something very different. And then I met him, and he was just sort of sitting there having a great time, you know, beer in hand and you know, most gregarious, lovely, warm, outgoing. You know, you don't look at at Feston and The Hunt and think that the guy who directed that is a real, you know, joyride. I was expecting someone quite dark and mysterious and scary, and he was just like the nicest, most fun guy, having a great time.
Got to be honest, I saw him introduce The Hunt at the London Film Festival and I had exactly the same thought. I was like, he's so young.
Like, wait, he's so young.
But when you're meeting a director for the first time and you don't know what they look like, is it? I mean, it's a bit like a platonic date, blind date anyway. Yeah. You're going up to people and going, is that the man that directed Feston? Or is that the guy?
Yeah,
or...
you've got to hope that they've seen you in something.
Right. Yes,
generally, if they don't, you're in a bad spot.
Yeah, there are directors that would just sit there and let you just suffer as you went through the entire Savoy asking everyone if they directed Feston. You're on a lot of buses today.
I know.
Are you getting... Kit Harington told us how when he was in Pompeii, he was getting his mates giving him abuse on text message about
this. For being on a bus.
For being on bus posters. They were like, you're fucking everywhere, was one of them. Do you get that kind of thing from people?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. My friend was like, you're ruining my commute. Because I go down onto the tube and you're on the tube and then I get up on the bus and you're on the bus and just get out of my commute. So yeah, to a degree. But I'm living in New York at the moment. So I'm getting a week's worth of abuse because I'm going back tomorrow. So I'm not getting it, you know, I'm sure I'll get text messages as it goes on.
You're ruining my commute.
I know. I was like, why? It's nice to see me. And she's like, yeah, it's nice to see you in the flesh, not your big stupid face on a poster.
There's not a lot you can say sort of to...
I'm very sorry, Mabel, but... You know, what can you do? Deal with it. It won't be there for very long.
We should mention your other cast, the other two leads, I guess the other two romantic, I hate the term romantic interest, but the other two men in the film, Mateusz Schoenaerts and Michael Sheen, who are both really terrific in this film. But I kind of wanted to ask you about the lamb.
Yeah, oh, the baby.
Because, my God, how did you say, I mean, you have a moment where you sort of, I guess you must have spent a few hours shooting with the lamb.
Yeah.
Was it a tough farewell?
Oh, my goodness. It was incredibly distracting as well. It was a problem. I was obsessed with this baby lamb.
It's very adorable.
And, you know, you suckle them, so you just put your finger in their mouth and they just suckle on your finger. And I could barely hear what Matthias was saying in that scene because I was just so into this lamb. And then at the end of the scene... I kind of put the lamb down on the floor and run out. And they did have a shot where they sort of panned down to the lamb and the lamb's just sort of like, where's she gone? You know, sort of looking around aimlessly. And oh, man, it was so sweet.
You can see the lamb was on the phone to its agent going, get me into the sequel.
Yeah, what?
What a three-picture deal. You mentioned how when you were on The Great Gatsby, you didn't want to see the Mia Farrow version before then. And I wondered if you felt the same way about the Julie Christie version of Far From the Madding Crowd.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Have you seen either of them since then?
No, neither of them.
I imagine it's suffocating.
It's just a bad vibe. You know, like, I hadn't seen neither of them. For Gatsby, it was, you know, Gatsby was ridiculous in terms of the expectation and the pressure that was on us. I guess because America's a bigger country, there are more people who are going to hate you statistically if you fuck it up. So we were...
Did you get haters? Did you get...
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I didn't read reviews for a long time on Gatsby. And then I think one night caved in and read some. And, you know, we had some nice reviews. We had some horrible reviews. And, you know, I think, you know, that's par for the course. But it was, that kind of pressure was just kind of pretty full on. It feels less like that for this, even though this is a beloved book and the Julie Christie version is also very beloved. But it doesn't help. It just messes you up, you know. And particularly when it's two extraordinary actresses, because I couldn't help but want to poach things from their performances if there were things that, you know, I would probably want to do. So, yeah, I think it's a bad thing. And now to do it would be, you know, difficult because I know what I've done and I would see them and think, oh, fuck, they did it better. And, you know, all that stuff that you go through. So maybe in like 20 years I'll watch them.
It was 5 years last time.
In 20 years.
Yeah. In 20 years' time, we'll have this conversation and you won't have seen them, will you?
And I'll say in 30 years from now.
But you are on the cover of both those books.
I know.
The first thing I do is probably send one to all my friends. And look, I'm on the cover of Penguin
Get
Classic.
Get out of my bookcase.
And I only got like a B at GCSE English, so eat that.
Yeah. Deal with it.
That's pretty unusual kind of fringe. I don't know if it's a benefit or just a weird thing that comes with doing adaptations.
It's a weird thing that comes out. You find yourself in bookshops, which is...
Did they send you a copy or do you have to buy your own?
Do you know what? They're really good for... Because you get asked a lot to, you know, auction stuff off a charity. And I always get loads of them if I've done... And get the whole cast to sign them. And then you've got like an easy, you know, thing. And, you know, and aunts and uncles like them as well.
I wanted to ask you, going back to your first day on a film set, that would have been Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah.
I think 2005, is that right?
Yeah.
Do you remember your first impressions of being on a film set?
Yeah, I do. I remember having no idea what was going on. But Joe Wright had us all together for a month before we started filming. So we, by the time, as actors, all of us were very close and very happy. But I didn't know, you know, I remember my first scene was with the whole family, me and Roz and Kieran, all the sisters, Brenda Bleth and Donald Sutherland, and then Judy Dench. And I'd met her, she'd come to one day of rehearsals that I was at. I'd met her, you know, like shaking her hand and passed out almost in the bathroom afterwards. But, you know, like, I hadn't spent any time with her. And that scene was with her. And she was sort of marching into our house in the middle of the night. And we were all in our pajamas. And Joe Wright came up to me after like three takes and they were shooting on us. And she was sort of barking at us and they were shooting the family. He took me aside and he said, "Kerry, you've got to do something with your face. You're just staring." And I was like, "Oh shit!" You know, and like, I just guess I think I thought, well, the camera's really far away, I just had no idea. You know, I really had no idea. And I spent the entire summer basically copying Jenna Malone because, you know, Jenna knew what she was doing, and so whatever Jenna did, I did basically.
And successfully, you did some stuff with your face that
I did. I did
really
some faces. Yeah, I did face some stuff. Face stuff. It took me a while, but yeah, I basically. You know, I basically did what Jenna did and then slowly got slightly more confident.
Do you remember any Nicholas Winding Refn pieces of direction that were akin to that? Because I imagine he had a few options.
Do stuff with your face. Nick's a trip. I mean, in every respect. Nick was incredibly... It's funny, the first time I met Nick...
This is on Drive, obviously, just to...
On Drive, yeah. First time I met Nick, we had a sort of shared dinner in Melbourne or something. He was there with Bronson, I was there with An Education, and we happened to be at the same dinner. And I really didn't like him at all. And I was sort of... I can't remember why. I think he was being funny. And anyway, he didn't really talk to me. And then a couple of years later for Drive, I walked into his living room to meet him for the first time. And he turned around and said, "Oh, Kerry, you were so much fatter the last time we met." And I was like, "What the fuck? Who's this guy?" You know, but I was obsessed with his films, completely obsessed with his films. And so sat down and we started talking. And it turns out he's just the best guy. Like, he's the nicest, warmest. And I ended up living with him and his family in LA when we were filming. So we became very, very good friends. I think, you know, I was cripplingly nervous for the first week of Drive because Ryan was sort of a little bit kind of in character and just very cool. And I was like, he hates me. He thinks I'm terrible. He doesn't want me here. Like, you know, I had this whole thing in my head where I was terrible casting and what am I doing here? So Nick was, rather than being straight up and quite forceful, he was very kind of, I think he was just trying to keep me from having a nervous breakdown, but he was kind of very sweet and sensitive and lovely. And of course, Ryan was as well, but it just took me about 5 days to stop panicking because it was Ryan Gosling.
We had Ryan Gosling on the podcast a couple of weeks ago and he was talking about the first meeting when they drove around.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's such a great Speedwagon. Story. Yeah.
And the story that I thought was that he'd stopped, he was high on pseudoephedrine because he had a bad cold or something, and he'd stopped talking and they were just sitting in the car in silence, and then they put the music on and they had like an exchange, a sort of looks, and it was, then the movie was there and all
the
this.
Movie
but
was
apparently
born.
He hadn't spoken to him the entire night.
No,
Ryan
no,
said.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
So that's a bit of a Nick. And Nick, he can be the silent type.
Yeah.
Good flatmate?
Oh, yeah. He's the best. Yeah.
Did he show you his... He has like Thunderbirds toys. I don't know if they're in
Denmark
or in
LA. They would have been in Denmark, yeah.
He's a collector of...
Oh, really?
Memorabilia. Yeah, he loves movie toys.
Wow, I didn't know that.
He collects all the Thunderbirds. And
yeah. Also not surprising.
Do you have any of those sorts of...
Collection things? No.
Is it true you were a racing car driver when you were growing up?
No. I used to watch Formula One with my dad religiously.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, when I was growing up. But no, I wasn't a sort of collector. I was like really into Michael Schumacher, and we grew up in Germany for a bit, so Dad and I used to watch Formula One religiously every Sunday. But no, I never got into a car, thank goodness.
Because you didn't learn to drive until...
Because I didn't learn to drive until... Later. Well, I learned to drive for Never Let Me Go, because Mark Romanek insisted that we use a manual car in that film. And then I learned to drive in a week, failed my test, and then we used an automatic car. And I felt incredibly cheated by the whole experience. but yeah, then I learned to drive a little bit later on, never got my license. It's the bane of my existence, really.
You haven't got a license now?
No. It's a problem.
Come and do Empire driving lessons.
Do you do Empire driving lessons?
No, but we'll start.
Okay.
If you need
yeah,
to drive around
Seriously,
Shaftesbury
I've
Avenue.
Got to... It's ridiculous. at this point. I'm 30 in a month and I can't drive.
Well, before you see
work on that,
before
right?
you see the Great Gatsby's, yeah. you need to learn to
somewhere
drive.
In that
drive
time.
To a screening. I have to wrap up in the not too distant future, but I have a question that you may hate, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Okay.
You how about that for an intro? you were very careful when an education came out, and I know that you sat with your agent, and your agent said to you, choose carefully, choose the things that you're really passionate about and you can't bear to not do.
Yeah.
And you have chosen carefully since then. You haven't made any stinking films at all.
Yeah.
You're kind of a clear IMDb page. But I wondered if what being in a franchise would mean for you now, because there are a lot of franchises out there. And as an adjunct to that, Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
Had any conversation? You don't have to say yes or no, but could you make a noise in answer to this question? Have you had any, when anyone approached you from Lucasfilm saying, what about something to do with Star Wars?
I can make a negative noise. And
oh, really?
I can say no.
Okay.
But Star Wars, I think, is a different deal. Like, Star Wars, I don't view in that kind of franchise. It's like Bond, I think. No. You know, they sort of stand apart from that stuff. Franchise stuff in general, like, I love watching. I love, but I've never found a role that's been interesting or sort of attractive in that way yet. And I also don't relish the idea of being incredibly well known for one part or one look, or particularly if there's a sort of sequel kind of vibe, because, you know, it's hard enough already tricking people into thinking you're different people. But if they constantly see you as that same person, it's even harder. So
if there was a superhero role on the table for you, it would need to be the one that you couldn't bear to see anyone else doing.
I think so, yeah. I think, you know, there's different kind of versions of that sort of thing. But yeah, on the whole, I think it's just sort of not wanting to... I think I'm really enjoying the kind of films that I'm doing at the moment.
Yes. I can imagine, certainly with Far From the Madding Crowd, why that would be the case. Because it's a great showcase and a really, really good movie as well. Last question. We also spoke to Bill Nighy, I think, in this very room, actually.
Oh, did you?
This was for the second best exotic Marilyn Hotel. And he told us about how he is I think he's the chairman of the Crystal Palace Football Club Supporters Club.
Yes.
And he is known there as El Presidente.
No
apparently.
Way.
Apparently, yes.
Okay, I'm going to use that.
So you should definitely call him El Presidente when you see him. But you've obviously been on stage with him in Skylights.
Yeah.
On Broadway. Has he got you along to Crystal Palace? Is he going to get you to Crystal Palace?
No. I don't talk about football with him. He talks about football with Matthew Beard, who plays his son in the play, and they talk about football and I tune out of it. But he is, the easiest way to wind up Bill is to pretend that you're about to tell him the results that you've read on your phone, because he has a rule that at work no one can talk about football results at all, because he goes home and tries to watch the games in some format online.
In New York?
Yeah. Okay. He's got the whole setup. Like, you know, he got them to buy like 8 different channels so that he could watch everything. But if you want to really piss him off, you get your phone out and go, oh, I'm on the sports page. Oh, Man U. And then start as if you're about to...
Does he cover his ears and do the whole...
He just goes mental. Does like he? He's like, oh, Kerry, I'm not even joking. I'm not even... You know, he's like really, really full on about it. So it's an easy way to wind him up.
Are you the same way about the Formula One results?
Oh, massively.
Really?
No, not anymore.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to us. Let's do a review of Far From the Madding Crowd. Hit it.
Let's do it. Oh my goodness, you're both awful. So this is an adaptation of the Thomas Hardy novel. Anyone who was forced through Thomas Hardy in school may remember him as being
forced through him. Well, great. Thanks for reviewing the film, Helen. Let's
no, but
move on.
Really, a little bit. May remember him as being incredibly long-winded.
Okay, I was going to say tedious.
Tedious, but... yes, okay. and let's face it, usually a downer at the end. But Far From the Madding Crowd is, I think, one of his best loved works, I think it's fair to say, like by people who don't have English degrees as well as those who do. And it basically focuses on Bathsheba Everdeen. And yes, Katniss was named after her, played by Carey Mulligan, who's a kind of, she's a spirited filly in the parlance probably of the times, in the sense that she has the means to be financially independent and essentially plans to be and has no wish to have some husband bossing her around. The problem, of course, being she lives in Victorian times, which means that, you know, that's the expectation of her, especially as she's young and gorgeous and has no reason not to marry. So she turns down the attentions of totally hunky sheep farmer Gabriel Oak, who's played by Matthias Schoenaerts. And then he falls on hard times and finds himself going to work for her just as she gets prosperous. Meanwhile, she has two new suitors. There's the patently unsuitable Sergeant Troy, played by Tom Sturridge, who has a very nice way with a uniform, but really nothing else to recommend him. And then Michael Sheen's lonely Mr. Boldwood, who is kind of shy and retiring at first, but turns out to be a little bit less, a little bit of a stalker. Like, sort of a Victorian 19th century stalker. A little bit. Just a tiny bit around the edges. Anyway, so it's sort of charting her own path through these various suitors and trying to find her own way and trying to be her own woman while also, you know, juggling everything that life throws at her. I think they've tried to position this as a bit of a kind of feminist story. And despite Mulligan's best efforts, I'm not quite sure that it is, because it still has that 19th century feel to it. She can't overcome the fact that her society really doesn't want her to be independent. But at the same time, there's a really nice relationship between Oak and Everdeen. They have a really nice, there's a really nice sense of them actually kind of growing together and growing to depend on one another, which I think it sets this apart from lots of quite shallow romances where they basically just see each other in uniform and go, oh my goodness, he's so dreamy. And I think that's really well done. Thomas Vinterberg shoots it all beautifully. It's really beautifully put together. There's a little bit of a sense sometimes of kind of rubbing away the novel's rough edges, I think it's fair to say. And they certainly kind of skim through quite a lot of years that are supposed to pass in quite a short space of time. It doesn't always give you the sense that actual time has actually passed, no matter how many montages of harvests they show us. But at the same time, it's so gorgeous that it's really hard to argue with. And well acted, I should say, by that cast as well. So we give it 4 stars, and I think that's about fair.
There's some great scenes of sheep farming.
There are, yes. Lots of sheep shearing.
Mm-hmm. Sheep shearing, and there's a sheep dip. And yep. There's a bit where the sheep all eat the wrong thing and they all kind of
blow up.
Swell up like furry space hoppers. And Matthias Schoenaerts has to kind of puncture them, which is fun if you're into sheep husbandry.
And who isn't?
Exactly, I ask you. I really enjoyed it. It is old-fashioned. It reminded me a little bit of, you know, what Spielberg was trying to do with War Horse, I think. Mm. You know, make it quite self-consciously old-fashioned. In this case, it did have a little bit of a, you know, a modern woman feel to it at the heart of it. And I thought that Carey Mulligan's very good. I think she's a talented actress.
Yeah.
And I also thought Michael Sheen was fabulous in the role.
Yeah.
He brings so much to what could have been a subsidiary character. Layers of depth and pain. And yeah, he was a bit stalkery, but I think it came from a place of loneliness and insecurity. And I think he's intrinsically well-meaning, but complex. And he conveys all of that with, you know, not necessarily very much to work with all the time. He's very, very good, and I enjoyed it. And you're right, I love Thomas Vinterberg. I think Festen is one of my favourite films, probably.
I thought it would be, Phil.
It's not one that you revisit regularly, but it is an absolute masterpiece, I believe. And it's good to see him back with The Hunt, obviously, which
yes.
is tougher than this.
A lot tougher.
This is not a tough film, which is kind of nice. I was sitting there thinking, I'm glad it's not a tough film. I don't want to see more sheep run off cliffs. I want to see, you know, something that's a little bit glossy. That was fine for me.
I feel like anybody who's having like pull dark withdrawal symptoms
yes.
like is totally going to love this. Like, it couldn't be better timed for coming after that, because that's been the big water cooler conversation up and down the country the last, what, six weeks. This is exactly what you need. I mean, it's set like 100 years later or something, but it's the same.
It's
different people, yeah. Same dreaminess. It's fine.
Are there scenes of sweaty, topless scything?
Sadly, there are smocks involved when the scythes come out, which is very upsetting indeed, because the smocks are horrible. But at the same time, it does have that feel about it. So what you lack in Killy, you make up for in
Philly.
It doesn't make any sense. Yes,
it kind of does.
I didn't know what I was
it kind of does. 4 stars then for Far From the Madding Crowd, or should I say 4? From the Madding Crowd.
Oh,
no, I probably shouldn't say that. Let's move on then to another film this week. This is a sequel to the film that made Gareth Edwards' name and reputation. Now look at him, he's doing Godzilla and Star Wars and all sorts of stuff. And it was Monsters, of course, a film I absolutely adore. Came out a few years ago. And this sequel is called Monsters: Dark Continent. Gareth Edwards is not the director, as you might expect. He's busy. Tom Green takes over the reins in this one. No, not that Tom Green, not the Freddy Godfingered guy, although that would be an interesting sequel. And this is more of a war film, isn't it, Phil Cat?
Correct, it is. This is Monsters: Dark Continent. The Dark Continent in question isn't really a continent. It's kind of Iraq, mm-hmm. in which we've moved forward from Gareth Edwards' movie. It's out of Central America. The scenario is the same. The infected zones have spread, and then you've had global conflict has filled the void as the monsters are still doing their tentacly business in the background. but they are very much in the background of this film. It doesn't do what Gareth Edwards did with the first film, which is set a road movie and a love story and a romance and human drama against a backdrop. They're even further away this time than monsters. They're not really even in the film in a dramatic sense. They're very much there, and there's visual fireworks to start with when you see how they, you know, how they deal with the sort of combatants that are going on around them. But really, at its heart, it's kind of a film about grunts doing battle with insurgents, which we've kind of seen. Nobody really talked about it very much at the time, but Generation Kill, the HBO show that followed up The Wire by David Simon, is really, really good, tackles all this stuff with so much more sophistication and so much more to say. This film, to me, has absolutely nothing whatsoever to say about anything. and I really did not enjoy it at all. I mean, I think it goes without saying that people have different views and films are subjective. I think if you enjoy the sort of the macho kind of testosterone-y combat stuff, you know, if you like the sequences in The Hurt Locker, which are basically just gun battles and the tension, this has lots of that. You know, there's a very good role in this film from Johnny Harris, who plays a kind of nutso sergeant.
Wait, hang on.
I know, believe
Johnny
it or not.
Johnny Harris,
I know,
nutso sergeant.
I know, but he gives great nutso in this. Our sort of cipher conduit through this world is Sam Keeley, who plays a soldier who's probably he's a newbie to all this. He's basically going into combat for the first time. A lot of Humvees, a lot of shooting, a lot of blowing up. There's some aliens in the background. It all ends in something that's sort of vaguely akin to Apocalypse Now. To me, it felt like a student film that got way out of control, and I really didn't like it at all. We've given it 4 stars. So I would say that, but you know, one person's art is another person's blood. So, you know, everyone has different views on stuff. I, for one, really did not like this film. I just felt it was hollow and noisy, and I didn't see what it was trying to say. I don't think it was trying to say very much, to be honest. But that said, if you like the combat stuff, you know, there is a lot of that, and that, you know, the action sequences are well handled, and you know, the monsters are there in the background. They occasionally interact with the dramatis personae, and those scenes are pretty good, but they aren't really, I didn't really quite figure out how to weave them into the story.
Okay, should we stop you there?
Yeah.
Before you
start
a petition.
But I should say that R. Kim liked it, because reading his review, I've sort of mentally made a note to see it. He gave it 4 stars, and you know, loved, I'm just reading here, but the snapshots of human behaviour in extreme circumstances. So I guess it's kind of a war film, essentially, with just that little extra element for him, anyway. We should say that the magazine liked it maybe more than Phil did, just to make that clear to anyone who was confused.
Yeah, agreed. We gave it 4 stars. Phil did not give it 4 stars.
No, I gave it 2 stars.
I'm giving Phil 3 stars for that review. It was very good, but you know. Also out this week is the latest Jason Blum high-concept, low-budget horror movie. It's called Unfriended. It largely takes place in a single shot, quite tricksy, based around the idea of social media. We gave it 1 3-star. We also have the prison drama We Are Monster, which we gave 3 stars to as well. And there's the documentary, the Sesame Street documentary, I Am Big Bird, which is charming and ramshackle, and shows the life of the guy who is Big Bird in real life. 3 stars for that one as well. And Phil, just very briefly,
yeah,
I believe that 8.5 is re-released this week.
Yes, it is, because I went to the BFI just last night and they had a promo for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
if you haven't seen Fellini's 8.5.
And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Jon Stewart, the Daily Show host, who's branching out into directing with Rosewater, in which Empire cameos.
Yes, it does.
It does.
3 times.
And Sarah Gayden, who's the star of A Royal Night Out as well, should be in the pod booth also. And do listen out once again for our Avengers Age of Ultron spoiler special podcast, which is out on Monday, or possibly earlier. Until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to help Sean Connery with his dial-up. He's having such problems with it these days. I don't understand. Goodbye.